6. A murder victim shows up on the island's only public beach, and the local law calls the editor of the local newspaper, Stephanie asked. Boy, that really isn't like murder, she wrote.
Life on the main coast is rarely like murder, she wrote, Dave said in his driest tone. And back then, we were pretty much what we are now, Steffi. Especially when the summer folk are gone, it's just us chickens, all in it together. That doesn't make it anything romantic, just kind of, I don't know, call it a sunshine policy. If everyone knows what there is to know, it stops a lot of tongues from a lot of useless wagon. And murder? Law? You're a little bit ahead of yourself there, ain't you?
Let her off the hook on that one, Vince said. We put the idea in her head ourselves talking about the coffee poisonings over in Tashmore.
Steffi, Chris Robinson delivered two of my children. My second wife, Alette, who I married 6 years after Joanne died, was good friends with the Robinson family, even dated Chris's brother Henry when they were in school together. It was the way Dave says, but it was more than business.
He put his glass of soda, which he called dope, on the railing, and then spread his hands open to either side of his face in a gesture she found both charming and disarming. I will hide nothing, it said.
We're a clubby bunch out here. It's always been that way. I think it always will be, because we'll never grow much bigger than we are now.
Thank God, Dave growled. No friggin' war, Matt.
Excuse me, Steffi.
She smiled and told him he was excused.
In any case, Vince said, I want you to take that idea of murder and set it aside, Steffi. Will you do that?
Yes.
I think you'll find that, in the end, you can't take it off the table or put it all the way back on. That's the way it is with so many things about the Colorado Kid and what makes it wrong for the Boston Globe, not to mention Yankee and Down East and Coast. It wasn't even right for the Weekly Islander, not really. We've reported it, oh yes, because we're a newspaper, and reporting is our job. I've got Ellen Dunwoody in the fire hydrant to worry about, not to mention the little Lester boy going to Boston for a kidney transplant, if he lasts long enough, that is. And of course, you need to tell folks about the end of summer hayride and dance out at the Gurnard Farms, don't you?
Don't forget the picnic, Stephanie murmured. It's all the pie you can eat, and folks won't want to know that. The two men laughed. Dave actually patted his chest with his hands to show she had gotten off a good one, as island folk put it.
Well, dear, Vince agreed, still smiling. But sometimes a thing happens, like two high school kids on their man and run finding a dead body on the town's prettiest beach, and you say to yourself, there must be a story in that. Not just reporting, what, why, when, where, and how, but a story. Then you discover there just isn't. That it's only a bunch of unconnected facts surrounding a true, unexplained mystery. And that, dear, is what folks don't want. It upsets them. It's too many waves. It makes them seasick.
Amen, Dave said. Now, why don't you tell the rest of it while we've still got some sunshine?
And Vince Teague did. 7.
We were in on it almost from the beginning. And by we, I mean Dave and me, the Weekly Islander. Although I didn't print what I was asked by Judge Wernis not to print. I had no problem with that, because there was nothing in that business that seemed to affect the island's welfare in any way. That's the sort of judgment call newspaper folk make all the time, Steffi. You'll make it yourself, and in time you get used to it. You just want to make sure you never get comfortable with it. The kids went back and guarded the body. Not that there was a lot of guarding to be done. Before Judge and Doc Robinson pulled up, they didn't see but 4 cars, all headed for town, and none of them slowed down when they saw a couple of teenagers jogging in place or doing stretching exercises there by the little hammock beach parking lot. When Judge and the Doc got there, they sent Johnny and Nancy on their way, And that's where they leave the story. Still curious the way people are, but on the whole glad to go, I have no doubt. George parked his Ford in the lot. Doc grabbed his bag, and they walked out to where the man was sitting against that litter barrel. He had slumped a little to one side again, and the first thing the doc did was to haul him up nice and straight. "Is he dead, Doc?" George said. "Oh, gory, he's been dead at least 4 hours, and probably six or more," Doc says. "It was right about then that I came pulling in and packed my Chevy beside George's Ford. He's as stiff as a board. Rigor mortis." "So you think he's been here since, what, midnight?" George asks. "He could have been here since last Labor Day, for all I know," Doc says. "But the only thing I'm absolutely sure of is that he's been dead since 2 this morning, because of the rigor. Probably he's been dead since midnight, but I'm no expert in stuff like that. If the wind was coming in stiff from offshore, that could have changed when the rigor set in." "No wind at all last night," I says, joining them. "Calm as the inside of a church bell." "Well, look at here, another damn country heard from," says Doc Robinson. "Maybe you'd like to pronounce the time of death yourself, Jimmy Olson." "No," I says, "I'll leave that to you." "I think I'll leave it to the county medical examiner," he says, "Cathcart over in Tinnock. State pays him an extra 11 grand a year for educated gut tossing. Not enough in my humble opinion, but each to his own. I'm just a GP, but, yeah, this fellow was dead by 2, I'll say that much. Dead by the time the moon went down." Then, for maybe a minute, the three of us just stood there, looking down on him like mourners. A minute can be an awful short space of time under some circumstances, but it can be an awful long one at a time like that. I remember the sound of the wind, still light, but starting to build in a little from the east. When it comes that way, and they're on the mainland side of the island, it makes such a lonely sound. "I know," Stephanie said quietly. "It kind of hoots." They nodded. That in the winter it was sometimes a terrible sound, almost the cry of a bereft woman, was a thing she did not know, and there was no reason to tell her. At last, I think it was just for something to say, George asked Doc to take a guess as to how old the fellow might be. "I'd put him right round 40, give or take 5 years," he says. "Do you think so, Vincent?" And I nodded, 40 seemed about right. And it occurred to me that it's too bad for a fellow to die at 40, a real shame. It's a man's most anonymous age. Then the doc seen something that interested him. He went down on one knee, which wasn't easy for a man of his size. He had to have gone 280 and didn't stand but 5'10" or so, and picked up the dead man's right hand, the one that had been lying on the beach. The fingers were curled a little, as if he'd died trying to make them into a tube he could look through. When Doc held his hand up, we could see some grit stuck to the insides of the fingers, and a little gnaw dusted on the palm. "What do you see?" George asks. "Don't look like anything but beach sand to me." "That's all it is. But why is it sticking?" Doc Robinson asks back. "This litter basket and all the others are planted well above the high tide line, as anyone with half a brain would know, and there was no rain last night. Sand's as dry as a bone. Also, look." He picked up the dead man's left hand. We all observed that he was wearing a wedding ring, and also that there was no sand on his fingers or palm. Doc put that hand back down and picked up the other one again. He tipped it a little so the light shone better on the inside. "There," he says, "do you see?" "What is that?" I ask. "Grease, little bit of grease." He smiled and said, "I think you win the teddy bear, Vincent. And see how his hand is curled?" "Yeah, like he was playing spyglass," George says. By then we was all three on our knees as if that litter basket was an altar, and we were trying to pray the dead guy back to life. "No, I don't think he was playing spyglass," Doc says. And I realized something, Steffi. He was excited in the way people only are when they've figured something out they know the likes of them have no business figuring out in the ordinary course of things. He looked into the dead man's face,
At least I thought it was his face Doc was looking at, but it turned out to be a little lower than that. Then back at the curled right hand.
"I don't think so at all," he says.
"Then what?" George says. "I want to get this reported to the state police and the attorney general's office, Chris. What I don't want is to spend the morning on my knees while you play Ulrich Quayne."
"See the way his thumb is almost touching his first finger and middle finger?" Doc asks us. And of course we did. If this guy had died looking through his rolled-up hand, his thumb would have been over his fingers, touching his middle finger and his third finger. Try it yourself if you don't believe me.
I tried it, and I'll be damned if he wasn't right.
"This isn't a tube," Doc says, once again touching the dead man's stiff right hand with his own finger. "This is a pincers. Combine that with the grease and those little bits of sand on the palm and the insides of the fingers, and what do you get?" I knew, but since George was the law, I let him say it. "If he was eating something when he died," he says, "where the hell is it?" Doc pointed to the dead man's neck, which even Nancy Arnault had noticed and thought of as puffy. And he says, "I've got an idea that most of it's still right in there where he choked on it. Hand me my bag, Vincent." I handed it over. He tried rummaging through it and found he could only do it one-handed and still keep all that meat balanced on his knees. He was a big man, all right, and he needed to keep at least one hand on the ground to keep himself from tipping over. So he hands the bag over to me and says, "I've got two otoscopes in there, Vincent, which is to say my little examination lights. There's my everyday and a spare that looks brand new. We're going to want both of them."
No, I don't know about this," George says. "I thought we were going to leave all this for Cathcart on the mainland.
He's the guy the state hired for work like this."
"I'll take the responsibility," Doc Robinson said. "Curiosity killed the cat, you know, but satisfaction brought him back snap-ass happy. You got me out here in the cold and damp without my morning tea or even a sliced toast. And I intend to have a little satisfaction if I can. Maybe I won't be able to, but I have a feeling."
"Vincent, you take this one. George, you take the new one, and don't drop it in the sand, please, and thank you. That's a $200 item. Now, I haven't been down on all fours like a little kid playing hussy since I was, I'm going to say, 7 years old, and if I have to hold the position long, I'm apt to fall on top of this fella. So you guys be quick and do just what I say. Have you ever seen how the folks in an art museum will train a couple of pin spots in a small painting and make it look all bright and pretty?" George hadn't, so Doc Robinson explained. When he was done, and was sure George Wernis got it, the island's newspaper editor knelt on one side of that sitting-up corpse, and the island's constable knelt on the other, each of us with one of the doc's little barrel lights in hand. Only instead of lighting up a work of art, we were going to light up the dead man's throat so that Doc could take a look. He got himself into position with a fair amount of grunting and puffing. Would have been funny if the circumstances hadn't been so strange, and if I hadn't been sort of afraid the man was going to have a heart attack right there. And then he reached out one hand, slipped it into the guy's mouth, and hooked down his jaw like it was a hinge, which, of course, when you think about it, is just what it is. "Now," he says, "get in close, boys. I don't think he's going to bite, but if I'm wrong, I'll be the one who pays for the mistake." We got in close and shone the lights down the dead man's gullet. It was just red and black in there, except for his tongue, which was pink. I could hear the doc puffing and grunting, and he says, not to us but to himself, "A little more." And he pulled down the lower jaw a little further. Then to us, "Lift him up, shine him straight down his gullet." And we did the best we could. It changed the direction of the light just enough to take the pink off the dead man's tongue and put it on that hanging thing at the back of his mouth, what do you call it, the uvula, Stephanie and Dave said at the same time. Vince nodded. "Beyond that, and just beyond it, I could see something or the top of something that was a dark gray,
'Twas only for 2 or 3 seconds, but it was enough to satisfy Doc Robinson. He took his fingers out of the dead man's mouth. The lower lip made a kind of plopping sound as it went back against the gum. The jaw stayed down pretty much where it was. And then he sat back, puffing away, 6 licks to the dozen. "You boys are going to have to help me stand up," he says when he got enough wind so he could talk. "Both my legs are asleep from the knees on down. Damn, but I'm a fool to weigh this much." "I'll help you up when you tell me," Josh says. "Did you see anything? Because I didn't see anything. What about you, Vincent?" "I thought I did," I says. The truth is, I knew friggin' well I did. "Pardon, Steph, but I didn't want to show him up." "It's back there, all right," Doc says. He still sounded out of breath, but he sounded satisfied, too, like a man who's scratched a troublesome itch. "Cathcart'll get it out, and then we'll know if it's a piece of steak or a piece of pork or a piece of something else, but I don't see that it matters. We know what matters. He came out here with a piece of meat in his hand and sat down to eat it while he watched the moonlight on the reach, propped his back up against this litter basket, and choked just like the little Indian in the nursery rhyme. On the last bite of what he brought to snack on? Maybe, but not necessarily. Once he was dead, a gull could have swooped in and taken what was left right out of his hand, Judge says. Just left the grease. Correct, Doc says. Now, are you two going to help me up, or do I have to crawl back over to Judge's car and pull myself up by the door handle? 8. "So, what do you think, Stuffy?" Vince asked, taking a throat-cooling swallow of his Coke. "Mystery solved? Case closed?" "Not on your granny," she cried, and barely registered their appreciative laughter. Her eyes were sparkling. "The cause of death part, maybe, but what was it, by the way, in his throat, or would that be getting ahead of the story?"
"Darling, you can't get ahead of a story that doesn't exist," Vince said, and his eyes were also sparkling. "Ask ahead, behind, or sideways. I'll answer anything. Same with Dave, I imagine."
As if to prove this was indeed so, the Weekly Islander's managing editor said,
"It was a piece of beef, probably steak, and very likely from one of your better cuts, your tenderloin, sirloin, or filet mignon. It was cooked medium rare, and asphyxiation due to choking was what went on the death certificate, although the man we have always called the Colorado Kid also had suffered a massive cerebral embolism. Your stroke, in other words. Cathcart decided the choking led to the stroking, but who knows, it might have been vice versa. So, you see, even the cause of death gets slippery when you look at it right up close."
"There's at least one story in here, a little one. I'm going to tell it to you now," Vince said. "It's about a fella who was in some ways like you, Stephanie, although I like to think you fell into better hands when it came to putting the final polish on your education. More compassionate ones, too. This fella was young, 23, I think, and like you, he was from away, the South in his case rather than the Midwest, and he was also doing graduate work in the field of forensic science."
"So he was working with this Dr. Cathcart, and he figured something out."
Vince grinned. "Logical enough guess, dear, but you're wrong about who he was working with. His name... what was his name, Dave?"
Dave Bowie, whose memory for names was as deadly as Annie Oakley's aim with her rifle, didn't hesitate.
"Devane. Paul Devane. That's right, I recall it now you say it. This young man, Devane, was assigned to 3 months of postgraduate fieldwork with a couple of state police detectives out of the Attorney General's office. Only in his case, sentenced might be the better word. They treated him very badly."
Vince's eyes darkened.
"Older people who use young people badly when all the young people want is to learn. I think folks like that should be put out of their jobs. All too often, though, they get promotions instead of pink slips. It has never surprised me that God gave the world a little tilt at the same time he set it spinning. So much that goes on here mimics that tilt. This young man, this Devane, spent 5 years at some place like Georgetown University, wanting to learn the side of science that catches crooks. And right around the time he was coming to Bud, the luck of the draw sent him to work with a couple of donut-eating detectives who turned him into little more than a gopher, running files between Augusta and Waterville and shooing looky-loos away from car crash scenes. Oh, maybe once in a while he got to measure a footprint or take flash photos of a tire print as a reward. But rarely, I should say, rarely. In any case, Steffi, these two fine specimens of detection, and I hope to God they're long out to pasture, happened to be in Tinoch Village at the same time the body of the Colorado kid turned up on Hammock Beach. They were investigating an apartment house fire of suspicious origin, as we say when reporting such things in the paper, and they had their pet boy, who was by then losing his idealism, with them. If he'd drawn a couple of good detectives working out of the AG's office, and I've met my share in spite of the goddamn bureaucracy that makes so many problems in the state's law enforcement system, or if his Department of Forensic Studies had sent him to some other state that accepts students, he might have ended up one of the fellas you see on that CSI show. "I like that show," Dave said. "Much more realistic than Murder, She Wrote." "Who's ready for a muffin? There's some in the pantry." It turned out they all were, and story time was suspended until Dave brought them back, along with a roll of paper towels. When each of them had a LaBrie's squash muffin and a paper towel to catch the crumbs, Vince told Dave to take up the tale.
"Because," he said, "I'm getting preachy and apt to keep us here till dark."
"I thought you was doing good," Dave said.
Vince clapped a bony hand to his even bonier chest.
"Call 911, Steffi, my hat just stopped."
"That won't be so funny when it really happens, old-timer," Dave said.
"Look at him spray those crumbs," Vince said. "You drool at one end of your life and dribble at t'other," my ma used to say. "Go on, Dave, tell on, but do us all a favor and swallow first."
Dave did, and followed the swallow with a big gulp of Coke to wash everything down. Steffi hoped her own digestive system would be up to such challenges when she reached David Bowie's age.
"Well," he said, "George didn't bother cordoning off the beach, because that would just have drawn folks like flies to a cow pie, don't you know. But that didn't stop those two dummies from the Attorney General's office from doing it. I asked one of them why they bothered, and he looked at me like I was a stark, raven, natural-born fool. 'Well, it's a crime scene, ain't it?' he says. 'Maybe so, and maybe no,' I says. 'But once the body's gone, what evidence do you think you're going to have that the wind hasn't blown away?' Because by then that easterly had gotten up awful fresh. But they insisted, and I will admit it made a nice picture on the front page of the paper, didn't it, Vince?"
"Yeah, picture with tape reading 'crime scene' in it always sells copies," Vince agreed.
Half of his muffin had already disappeared, and there were no crumbs Steffi could see on his paper towel. Dave said,
"Devane was there while the medical examiner, Cathcart, got a look at the body. The hand with the sand on it, the hand with none, and then into the mouth. But right about the time the Tinoch funeral home hearse that had come over on the 9 o'clock ferry pulled up, those two detectives realized that he was still there, and might be getting something perilously close to an education. They couldn't have that. So they sent him to get coffee and donuts and danishes for them, and Cathcart and Cathcart's assistant and the two funeral home boys who'd just shown up. Devane didn't have any idea where to go, and by then I was on the wrong side of the tape, Dade Strong, so I took him down to Jenny's bakery myself. Took half an hour, maybe a little more, most of it spent riding, and I got a pretty good idea of how the land lay with that young man, although I give him all points for discretion. He never told a single tale out of school, simply said he wasn't learning as much as he'd hoped to, and seeing the kind of errand he'd been sent on while Cathcart was doing his in-situ examination, I could connect the dots. But when we got back, the examination was over.
The body had been zipped away in a body bag. That didn't stop one of those detectives, a big, beefy guy named O'Shanny, from giving Devane the rough side of his tongue. "What took you so long? We're freezing our butts off out here, on and on, yada, yada, yada." Devane stood up to it well. Never complained, never explained. Someone surely raised him right, I have to say. So I stepped in and said we'd gone and come back as fast as anyone could. I said, "You wouldn't have wanted us to break any speed laws now, would you, officers?" Hoping to get a little laugh and kind of lighten the situation, you know. Didn't work, though. The other detective, his name was Morrison, said, "Who asked you, Irving? Haven't you got a yard sale to cover or something?" His partner got a laugh out of that one, at least, but the young man who was supposed to be learning forensic science and was instead learning that O'Shanny liked white coffee and Morrison took his black, blushed all the way down to his collar. Now, Steffi, a man doesn't get to the age I was even then without getting his ass kicked a number of times by fools with a little authority, but I felt terrible for Devane, who was embarrassed not only on his own account, but on mine as well. I could see him looking for some way to apologize to me, but before he could find it, or before I could tell him it wasn't necessary, since it wasn't him that had done anything wrong, O'Shanny took the tray of coffees and handed it to Morrison, then the two sacks of pastries from me. After that, he told Devane to duck under the tape and take the evidence bag with the dead man's personal effects in it. "You sign the possession slip," he says to Devane, like he was talking to a 5-year-old, "and you make sure nobody else so much as touches it until I take it back from you. And keep your nose out of the stuff inside yourself. Have you got all that?" "Yes, sir," Devane says. He gives me a little smile. I watched him take the evidence bag, which actually looked like the sort of accordion folder you see in some offices, from Dr. Cathcart's assistant. I saw him slide the possession slip out of the see-through envelope on the front, and... "Do you understand what that slip's for, Steffi?"
"I think I do," she said. "Isn't it so that if there's a criminal prosecution and something found at the crime scene is used as evidence in that prosecution, the state can show an uncorrupted chain of possession from where that thing was found to where it finally ended up in some courtroom as Exhibit A?"
"Prettily put," Vince said. "You should be a writer."
"Very amusing," Steffi said.
"Yes, ma'am, that's I, Vincent, a regular Oscar Wilde," Dave said. "At least when he's not being Oscar the Grouch. Anyway, I saw young Mr. Devane sign his name to the possession slip, and I saw him put it back into the sleeve on the front of the evidence bag. Then I saw him turn to watch those strong boys load the body onto the funeral hack. Vince had already come back here to start writing his story, and that was when I left, too, telling the people who asked me questions. Quite a few had gathered by then, drawn by that stupid yellow tape like ants to spilled sugar, that they could read all about it for just a quarter, which is what the Islander went for in those days. Anyway, that was the last time I actually saw Paul Devane standing there and watching those two wide bodies load the dead man into the hearse. But I happen to know Devane disobeyed O'Shanny's order not to look in the evidence bag, because he called me at the Islander about 16 months later. By then, he'd given up his forensic science dream and gone back to school to become a lawyer. Good or bad, that particular cost correction's down to A.G. Detectives O'Shanny and Morrison. But it was still Paul Devane who turned the Hammock Beach John Doe into the Colorado Kid, and eventually made it possible for the police to identify him. "And we got the scoop," Vince said, "in large part because Dave Bowie here bought that young man a donut and gave him what money can't buy, an understanding ear and a little sympathy." "Oh, that's laying it on a little thick," Dave said, shifting around in his seat. "I went with him more than 30 minutes, maybe 3/4 of an hour if you want to add in the time we stood in line at the bakery."
"Sometimes maybe that's enough," Stephanie said.
Dave said,
"Well, sometimes maybe it is. And what's so wrong about that?" How long do you think it takes a man to choke to death on a piece of meat and then be dead forever? None of them had an answer to that. On the reach, some rich summer man's yacht tooted with hollow self-importance as it approached the Tinnock town dock.
9.
Let Paul Devane alone a while, Vince said. Dave can tell you the rest of that part in a few minutes. I think maybe I ought to tell you about the gut-tossing first.
Yeah, Dave said. It ain't a story, Steph, but that part'd probably come next if it was.
Vince said, don't get the idea that Cathcart did the autopsy right away, because he didn't. There had been two people killed in the apartment house fire that brought O'Shanney and Morrison to our neck of the woods to begin with, and they came first. Not just because they died first, but because they were murder victims and John Doe looked like being just an accident victim. By the time Cathcart did get to John Doe, the detectives had gone back to Augusta and good riddance to them. I was there for that autopsy when it finally happened, because I was the closest thing there was to a professional photographer in the area back in those days, and they wanted a sleeping ID of the guy. That's a European term, and all it means is a kind of portrait shot presentable enough to go into the newspapers. It's supposed to make a cop look like he's actually snoozing.
Stephanie looked both interested and appalled. Does it work?
No, Vince said. Then, well, perhaps to a kid, or if you was to look at it quick with one eye winked shut. This one had to be done before the autopsy, because Cathcart thought maybe, with the throat blockage and all, he might have to stretch the lower jaw too far.
And you didn't think it would look quite so much like he was sleeping if he had a belt tied around his chin to keep his mouth shut? Stephanie asked, smiling in spite of herself. It was awful that such a thing should be funny, but it was funny. Some appalling creature in her mind insisted on popping up one sicko cartoon image after another.
Nope. Probably not, Vince agreed, and he was also smiling.
Dave, too. So if she was sick, she wasn't the only one, thank God.
What such a thing would look like, I think, would be a corpse with a toothache.
Then they were all laughing. Stephanie thought that she loved these two old buzzards. She really did.
Got to laugh at the Reaper, Vince said, plucking his glass of Coke off the railing.
He helped himself to a sip, then put it back.
Especially when you're my age. I sense that bugger behind every door, and smell his breath on the pillow beside me where my wives used to lay their heads, God bless them both, when I put out my light. Got to laugh at the Reaper. Anyway, Steffi, I took my headshots, my sleeping IDs, and I came out about as you'd expect. Best one made the fellow look like he might have been sleeping off a bad drunk, or maybe in a coma, and that was the one we ran a week later. They also ran it in the Bangor Daily News, plus the Ellsworth and Portland papers. Didn't do any good, of course, not so far as scaring up people who knew him, at least. And we eventually found out there was a perfectly good reason for that. In the meantime, though, Cathcart went on about his business. And with those two dumbbells from Augusta gone back to where they came from, he had no objections to me hanging around as long as I didn't put it in the paper that he'd let me. I said, of course I wouldn't, and of course I never did. Working from the top down, there was first that plug of steak Doc Robinson had already seen in the guy's throat. That's your cause of death right there, Vince, Cathcart said, and the cerebral embolism, which he discovered long after I'd left to catch the ferry back to Moosey, never changed his mind. He said that if the guy had had someone there to perform the Heimlich maneuver, or if he'd performed it on himself, he might never have wound up on the steel table with the gutters running down the sides. Next, contents of the stomach number one, and by that I mean the stuff on top, the midnight snack that had barely had a chance to start digesting when our man died and everything shut down. Just steak, maybe 6 or 7 bites in all. Well chewed. Cathcart thought maybe as much as 4 ounces. Finally, contents of the stomach number 2. And here I'm talking about our man's supper. This stuff was pretty much, well, I don't want to go into details here, Let's just say that the digestive process had gone on long enough so that all Dr. Cathcart could tell for sure, without extensive testing, was that the guy had had some sort of fish dinner, probably with a salad and French fries, round 6 or 7 hours before he died. "I'm no Sherlock Holmes, Doc," I says, "but I can go you one better than that." "Really?" he says, kind of skeptical. "Yeah," I says. "I think he had his supper either at Curly's or Jan's Wharfside over here, or Yanko's on Mooslock. Why one of those when there's got to be 50 restaurants within a 20-mile radius of where we're standing that sell fish dinners, even in April?" he asks. "Why not the Grey Gull, for that matter?" "Because the Grey Gull would not stoop to selling fish and chips," I says. "And that's what this guy had." Now, Steffi, I'd done okay through most of the autopsy, but right about then I started feeling decidedly chuck-upsy. "Those three places I mentioned sell fish and chips," I says, "and I could smell the vinegar as soon as you cut his stomach open." And then I had to rush into his little bathroom and throw up. But I was right. I developed my sleeping ID pictures that night and showed them around at the places that sold fish and chips the very next day. No one at Yanko's recognized him, but the takeout girl at Jan's Wharfside knew him right away. She said she served him a fish and chips basket plus a Coke or a Diet Coke, she couldn't remember which, late on the afternoon before he was found. He took it to one of the tables and sat eating and looking out at the water. I asked if he said anything, and she said not really, just please and thank you. I asked if she noticed where he went when he finished his meal, which he ate around 5:30, and she said no. He looked at Stephanie. "My guess is probably down to the town dock to catch the 6 o'clock ferry to Moosey. The time would have been just about right." "Well, that's what I've always figured," Dave said.
Stephanie sat up straight as something occurred to her. It was April, the middle of April on the coast of Maine, but he had no coat on when he was found. Was he wearing a coat when he was served at Jan's? Both of the old men grinned at her as if she had just solved some complicated equation. Only Stephanie knew their business, even at the humble Weekly Islander level, was less about solving than it was delineating what needed to be solved.
"That's a good question," Vince said. "Lovely question," Dave agreed. "I was saving that, Pat," Vince said, "but since there's no story exactly, saving the good Pats doesn't matter. And if you want answers, dear heart, the story's closed. The takeout girl at Jan's didn't remember for sure, and no one else remembered him at all. I suppose we have to count ourselves lucky in a way. Had he bellied up to that counter in mid-July, when such places have a million people in them all wanting fish and chips baskets, lobster rolls, and ice cream sundaes, she wouldn't have remembered him at all, unless he'd dropped his trousers and mooned her."
"Maybe not even then," Stephanie said.
"That's true. As it was, she did remember him, but not if he was wearing a coat. I didn't press it too hard on it, either, knowing that if I did, she might remember something just to please me, or to get me out of her hair. She said, 'I seem to recall he was wearing a light green jacket, Mr. Teague, but that could be wrong, and maybe it was wrong, but, you know, I tend to think she was right, that he was wearing such a jacket.'"
"Then where was it?" Stephanie asked. "Did such a jacket ever turn up?"
"No," Dave said. "So maybe there was no jacket. Although what he was doing outside on a raw seacoast night in April, without one, certainly beggars my imagination."
Stephanie turned back to Vince, suddenly with 1,000 questions, all urgent, none fully articulated.
"What are you smiling about, dear?" Vince asked. "I don't know." She paused. "Yes, I do. I have so goddamn many questions, I don't know which one to ask first."
Both of the old men whooped at that one. Dave actually fished a big handkerchief out of his back pocket and mopped his eyes with it.
"Ain't that a cocker?" he exclaimed. "Yes, ma'am, I tell you what, Steph.
Why don't you pretend you're drawn for the Tupperware set at the Ladies' Auxiliary Autumn Sale? Just close your eyes and pick one out of the goldfish bowl.
All right, she said, and although she didn't quite do that, it was close. What about the dead man's fingerprints and his dental records? I thought that when it came to identifying dead people, those things were pretty much infallible.
Most people do, and probably they are, Vince said. But you have to remember, this was 1980, Steph.
He was still smiling, but his eyes were serious. Before the computer revolution, and long before the Internet, that marvelous tool young folks such as yourself take for granted. In 1980, you could check the prints and dental records of what police departments call an unsub, an unknown subject, against those of a person you thought your unsub might be. But checking them against the prints or dental records of all the wanted felons on file in all the police departments would have taken years. And against those of all the folks reported disappeared every year in the United States? Even if you narrowed the list down to just men in their 30s and 40s? Not possible, dear.
But I thought the armed forces kept computer records even back then.
I don't think so, Vince said. And if they did, I don't believe the kids' prints were ever sent to them.
In any case, the initial ID didn't come from the man's fingerprints or dental work, Dave said.
He laced his fingers over his considerable chest and appeared almost to preen in the day's late sunshine, now slanting but still warm.
I believe that's known as cutting to the chase.
So where did it come from?
That brings us back to Paul Devane, Vince said. And I like coming back to Paul Devane because, as I said, there's a story there, and stories are my business. They're my beat, we would have said back in the old, old days. Devane's a little sip of Horatio Alger, small but satisfying. Strive and succeed. Work and win.
Piss and vinegar, Dave suggested.
If you like, Vince said evenly.
Sure, yeah, if you like.
Devane goes off with those two stupid cops, O'Shanny and Morrison, as soon as Cathcart gives them the preliminary report on the burn victims from the apartment house fire, because they don't give a heck about some accidental choking victim who died over on Moose Lookout Island. Cathcart, meanwhile, does his gut-tossing on John Doe, with yours truly in attendance. On to the death certificate goes asphyxiation due to choking, or the medical equivalent thereof. Into the newspapers goes my sleeping ID photo, which our Victorian ancestors much more truthfully called a death portrait, and no one calls the Attorney General's office or the State Police Barracks in Augusta to say that's their missing father or uncle or brother. Tinnock Funeral Home keeps him in their cooler for 6 days. It's not the law, but like so many things in matters of this sort, Steffi, you discover it's an accepted custom. Everybody in the death business knows it, even if nobody knows why. At the end of that period, when he was still John Doe and still unclaimed, Abe Cavey went on ahead and embalmed him. He was put into the funeral home's own crypt at Seaview Cemetery. This part's rather creepy, Stephanie said. She found she could see the man in there, for some reason not in a coffin, although he must surely have been provided with some sort of cheap box, but simply laid on a stone slab with a sheet over him, an unclaimed package in a post office of the dead.
"Yeah, 'tis a bit," Vince said levelly. "Do you want me to push on?"
"If you stop now, I'll kill you," she said. He nodded, not smiling now, but pleased with her just the same. She didn't know how she knew that, but she did. He bided the summer and half the fall in there. Then, when November come around, and the body was still unnamed and unclaimed, they decided they ought to bury him. In Vince's Yankee accent, bury rhymed with furry. Before the ground stiffened up again and made digging particularly hard, don't you see?
I do, Stephanie said quietly.
And she did. This time she didn't sense the telepathy between the two old men, but perhaps it was there because Dave took up the tale, such tale as there was, with no prompting from the Islander's senior editor.
Devane finished out his tour with O'Shanny and Morrison to the bitter end, he said.
He probably even gave them each a tie or something at the end of his 3 months or his quarter or whatever it was. As I think I told you, Stephanie, there was no quit in that young fella. But as soon as he was finished, he put in his paperwork at whatever his college was. I think he told me Georgetown, but you mustn't hold me to that. And started back up again, taking whatever courses he needed for law school. And except for two things, that might have been where Mr. Paul Devane leaves this story, which, as Vince says, isn't a story at all, except maybe for this part. The first thing is that Devane peeked into the evidence bag at some point and looked over John Doe's personal effects. The second is that he got serious about a girl, and she took him home to meet her parents, as girls often do when things get serious. And this girl's father had at least one bad habit that was more common then than it is now. He smoked cigarettes.
Stephanie's mind, which was a good one, both of the men knew this, at once flashed upon the pack of cigarettes that had fallen onto the sand of Hammock Beach when the dead man fell over. Johnny Graveland, now Moose Lick's mayor, had picked it up and put it back into the dead man's pocket. And then something else came to her. Not in a flash, but in a blinding glare. She jerked as if stung. One of her feet struck the side of her glass and knocked it over. Coke fizzed across the weathered boards of the porch and dripped between them to the rocks and weeds far below. The old men didn't notice. They knew a state of grace perfectly well when they saw one, and were watching their intern with interest and delight.
"The tax stamp!" she nearly shrieked. "There's a state tax stamp on the bottom of every pack!"
They both applauded her, gently but sincerely.
10. Dave said,
"Let me tell you what young Mr. Devane saw when he took his forbidden peek into the evidence bag, Steffi. And I have no doubt he took that look more to spite those two than because he actually believed he'd see anything of value in such a scanty collection of stuff. To start with, there was John Doe's wedding ring, a plain gold band, no engraving, not even a date.
They didn't leave it on his..." She saw the way the two men were looking at her, and it made her realize that what she was suggesting was foolish. If the man was identified, the ring would be returned. He might then be committed to the ground with it on his finger if that was what his surviving family wanted. But until then, it was evidence, and had to be treated as such. "No," she said. "Of course not. Silly me. One thing, though. There must have been a Mrs. Doe somewhere. Or a Mrs. Kidd. Yes?"
"Yes," Vince Teague said rather heavily. "And we found her. Eventually."
"And were there little does?" Stephanie asked, thinking that the man had been the right age for a whole gaggle of them.
"Let's not get stuck on that part of it just now, if you please," Dave said.
"Oh," Stephanie said, "sorry."
"Nothing to be sorry about," he said, smiling a little. "Just don't want to lose my place. It's easier to do when there's no, oh, what would you call it, Vincent?"
"No through line," Vince said.
He was smiling, too, but his eyes were a little distant. Stephanie wondered if it was the thought of the little does that had put that distance there.
"No, no through line at all," Dave said.
He thought, then proved how little he'd lost his place by ticking items rapidly off on his fingers.
"Contents of the bag was the deceased's wedding ring, $17 in paper money, a 10, a 5, and 2 ones, plus some assorted change that might have added up to a buck. Also, Devane said, one coin that wasn't American. He said he thought the writing on it was Russian."
"Russian?" she marveled.
"What's called Cyrillic," Vince murmured.
Dave pressed ahead.
"There was a roll of certs and a pack of big red chewing gum with all but one stick gone. There was a book of matches with an ad for stamp collecting on the front. I'm sure you've seen that kind. They hand them out at every convenience store. And Devane said he could see a strike mark on the strip across the bottom for that purpose, pink and bright. And then there was that pack of cigarettes, open and with one or two cigarettes gone. Devane thought only one, and the single strike mark on the matchbook seemed to bear that out," he said.
"But no wallet," Stephanie said.
"No, ma'am."
"And absolutely no identification?"
"Nope."
Did anyone theorize that maybe someone came along and stole Mr. Doe's last piece of steak and his wallet? She asked, and a little giggle got out before she could put her hand over her mouth.
Steffi, we tried that and everything else, Vince said, including the idea that maybe he got dropped off on Hammock Beach by one of the coast lights.
Some 16 months after Johnny Graveland and Nancy Arnault found that fella, Dave resumed, Paul Devane was invited to spend a weekend at his lady friend's house in Pennsylvania. I have to think that Moose Lookout Island, Hammock Beach, and John Doe were all about the last things on his mind just then. He said he and the girlfriend were going out for the evening to a movie or something. Mother and Dad were in the kitchen finishing the supper dishes, doing the ridden up is what we say in these parts. And although Paul had offered to help, he'd been banished to the living room on the grounds of not knowing where anything went. So he was sitting there, watching whatever was on the TV, and he happened to glance over at Papa Bear's easy chair, and there on Papa Bear's little end table, right next to Papa Bear's TV guide and Papa Bear's ashtray, was Papa Bear's pack of smokes.
He paused, giving her a smile and a shrug.
It's funny how things work sometimes. Makes you wonder how often they don't. If that pack had been turned a different way so the top had been facing him instead of the bottom, John Doe might have gone on being John Doe, instead of first the Colorado Kid, and then Mr. James Cogan of Nederland, a town just west of Boulder. But the bottom of the pack was facing him, and he saw the stamp on it. It was a stamp like a postage stamp, and that made him think of the pack of cigarettes in the evidence bag that day. You see, Steffi, one of Paul Devane's minders, I disremember if it was O'Shanny or Morrison, had been a smoker, and among Paul's other chores, he'd bought this fella a fair smack of Camel cigarettes, and while they also had a stamp on them, it seemed to him it wasn't the same as the one on the pack in the evidence bag. It seemed to him that the stamp on the State of Maine cigarettes he bought for the detective was an ink stamp, like the kind you sometimes get on your hand when you go to a small-town dance, or, I don't know.
To the Gurnard Farms hayride and picnic? She asked, smiling.
You got it, he said, pointing a plump finger at her like a gun. Anyway, this wasn't the kind of thing where you jump up yelling, Eureka, I have found it. But his mind kept returning to it over and over again that weekend, because the memory of those cigarettes in the evidence bag bothered him. For one thing, it seemed to Paul Devane that John Doe's cigarettes certainly should have had a Maine tax stamp on them, no matter where he came from. Why? Because there was only one gone. What kind of cigarette smoke only smokes one in 6 hours?
A light one?
A man who has a full pack and don't take but one cigarette out of it in 6 hours ain't a light smoker. That's a non-smoker, Vince said mildly. Also, Devane saw the man's tongue. So did I. I was on my knees in front of him, shining Doc Robinson's otoscope into his mouth. It was as pink as peppermint candy. Not a smoker's tongue at all.
Oh, and the matchbook, Steffi said thoughtfully. One strike? Vince Teague was smiling at her, smiling and nodding.
One strike, he said.
No lighter?
No lighter.
Both men said it together, then laughed.